From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The governor announced that he will be deploying the National Guard in the coming days in anticipation of a decision by the grand jury out in Clayton.
That was St. Louis Mayor Francis G. Slay speaking at a press conference late Monday, discussing an order of Missouri's Governor Jay Nixon declaring a state of emergency and calling out the National Guard to maintain order in the St. Louis region when a grand jury decision is announced in the Michael Brown case. Nixon's executive order put the St. Louis Police Department in charge of security for Ferguson. The order also establishes a unified law enforcement command consisting of county police, St. Louis police, and the Missouri Highway Patrol. We'll have more on what the deployment of the National Guard in Ferguson could mean on the ground later in this newscast when we'll speak with the sister of one of the Kent State student protesters who were shot and killed by the Ohio National Guard during an anti-war protest in May 1970. Four people were killed and at least six wounded when two assailants attacked worshippers with knives and axes in a synagogue in Jerusalem Tuesday. The incident follows the death of a 32-year-old Palestinian bus driver who was found hanged in his vehicle Monday, an incident Israeli police described as a suicide, but which the driver's family believes was the result of an attack. RT's Paula Slyer reports from Tel Aviv.
Four Israelis have been killed while they were praying and studying at a Jewish seminary and synagogue in Jerusalem. The reports suggest that three assailants entered the premises. Initial reports suggested that one managed to escape. Now, they were holding guns and axes as well as knives. Eight people were injured. Four of them are in a serious condition. The two assailants were shot dead at the scene by Israeli security, and initially, there were reports issued for people in the area not to exit their houses as a third assailant was on the loose, but that alert has been pushed down. At the same time, another assailant was apprehended in Tel Aviv. He was just about to carry out a stabbing incident. Now, this comes after clashes last night after a bus driver was buried. Now, an autopsy showed that he had committed suicide, but tensions are high on the ground amid some reporting that he was killed by Israeli security.
These two communities cannot live together. Each of them get different perspective, different narrative.
And violence is on the rise again, prompting many to ask if a third intifada is on its way.
It's a different intifada because in the first and the second intifadas, there was a very clear starting date. With this particular phase of the Palestinian struggle against apartheid and occupation, there is no clear one day in which this started.
But each day the violence rises a notch, provoked this time by Israel's restrictions to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, a site holy to Muslims, located on the Temple Mount, hugely symbolic for Jews. First, a Palestinian rams his car into Israeli passengers at a railway station, killing two, including a three-month-old baby. 10 days later, another Palestinian does the same. Two Israelis die, 14 are wounded. Outside a West Bank settlement, a young Israeli woman is stabbed to death.
There is a little bit third intifada. You can't say it's exactly intifada, but there is problems, yes. Definitely there is problems.
I think it's going to be the third intifada. Yeah, it's the beginning. And it started before a long time.
Hamas has praised the attacks, calling for what it terms Israel's racism and occupation to be increasingly resisted. Other extremist groups have followed suit.
We hope that these things lead to the third intifada because we believe that if peace process will continue without any end, the Israeli will take more and more lands, will destroy more and more houses and places, and will attack and will kill more.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has dared rioting Arabs to live under Palestinian rule in the West Bank and Gaza, to which a prominent Arab-Israeli legislator retorted the Prime Minister had gone off the rails. As the rhetoric mounts, so does the casualty count, and the fear that the third intifada might not be starting, but instead is already here. Paul Islier, RT, Tel Aviv.
Meanwhile, international support for an independent state of Palestine is spreading rapidly. RT's Rory Suchet has more.
Well, while things are deteriorating in the West Bank, the struggle for a Palestinian state is gaining more support in Europe. Spain could become the next country to recognise Palestine, with its parliament holding a symbolic vote later today. Now, that's after moral backing was received from other European nations. Sweden was the first officially recognising Palestine last month. British MPs held a non-binding vote, a move that was quickly condemned by Israel. Soon after, the upper house of the Irish parliament did the same. And as well as Spain, France will vote next week on the issue, and Italy is discussing it. Palestinian activist Mustafa al-Barghouti says that tensions will not subside until Palestinians are allowed to go on their own.
The basic and root problem here is the continuation of the system of apartheid and occupation, the longest occupation in modern history, and the fact that Palestinian people are not free since a very long time. And the only solution to this, the only way to stop violence, is to allow Palestinians to be free, to end occupation, and to end the system of racial discrimination that Israeli government is practicing against Palestinian population.
Huge crowds of protesters hit the streets of the Greek capital Monday on the anniversary of an uprising against a military junta 41 years ago, and amid tensions over continuing economic hardship and government cutbacks. Press TV's Kostin Mitzalis reports from Athens.
Politicians, students and civilians lay wreaths and flowers in memory of the students killed by the army and police on November 17, 1973, right here at Athens Polytechnic. Later in the afternoon, Athens rocked by tens of thousands of protesters, fueled by both the symbolic and the contemporary significance of the students' revolt.
41 years after the historical events of 1973, the students' demands, past and present, remain unfulfilled. Our national independence is at stake, and so is education, health and the welfare and freedom of Greek people. If politics in Greece do not change soon, claims for democracy, old and new, will remain a mere wish as the crisis deepens irreversibly.
Back then it was the army generals, the dictators. Now we have austerity. Private banks help legislate laws that take our wages and students study without textbooks. Greek pensioners commit suicide out of poverty. So how can anyone say things are different 40 years later?
In the evening, the marchers reached the US embassy where police launched flashbangs and tear gas, but the mammoth rally continued regardless. Against continued austerity spending cuts in education, hundreds of schools nationwide were occupied by students last month, and for the first time ever since the Greek junta, the police last week violently evacuated universities ahead of these protests.
41 years ago, Greek students occupied the Athens Polytechnic and helped overturn the military junta. This year, they're back out in the streets, gaining fresh anti-austerity momentum. However, most universities in the Greek capital Athens remain locked in collaboration between deans and the police. Kostin Venizelos, Press TV Athens.
And protests continue on the streets of Mexico over the 43 missing student teachers, as Mexican federal intelligence sources told the Milenio newspaper Monday that the Iguala mayor, who was arrested for allegedly masterminding the forced disappearance of the students in September, was among a dozen Mexican mayors who had been investigated between January and July of this year for alleged links to criminal groups. That report followed news that Cuauhtemoc Cardenas, the founder and three-time presidential candidate of the leftist Party of the Democratic Revolution, or PRD, has requested the resignation of PRD President Carlos Navarrete and the entire National Executive Committee, saying that the party has lost its credibility over the case of the missing students and faces the worst crisis in its history. Protest organizers say the nationwide strike called for this Thursday will take place as scheduled. We will continue to follow this story as it develops. Syria's envoy to the UN slammed the Security Council's approach to terror threats in his country Monday, saying its politicized anti-Damascus resolutions merely increase the suffering of the Syrian people. We have this report from Press TV.
The Syrian envoy to the United Nations has blamed the world body for increasing the Syrian people's pain. Bashar al-Jafari said the UN resolutions are politicized and unfair and make the Syrians suffer more. He also slammed the UN's approach towards terrorists, saying the world body's decisions give the green light to terrorists to go ahead with their crimes. He made the comments during a speech before the UN on human rights. Jafari also added that turning a blind eye to militants' atrocities would help spread terrorism.
Attention to the fact that the way the
Our New York correspondent Caleb Maupin says the UN Security Council statements mostly blame the crisis on the Syrian government.
In the UN Security Council, every statement that was made on the Syrian crisis was worded in a way that it was either ambiguous or it somehow put blame upon the Syrian government. Even though this fighting came purely from the insurgency, was a prolonged insurgency that did not have popular support in Syria among the population, while it may have had a small base of support at one time, the overwhelming majority of the Syrian population does not support these insurgents, and most of these insurgents are foreign fighters. In spite of that, the UN Security Council increasingly, in most of the meetings, especially statements by a UN ambassador representing the United States, Samantha Power, the statements attempted to blame the crisis on the Syrian government. So I think, he's pointing out, which is really the undisputed reality, that the role of foreign Western powers in fomenting this conflict is real, and the UN Security Council was a place in which that took place. The Western media, along with the words that came out of representatives of Western states, whether it be the United States, Britain, France, the rhetoric that they used, they tried to create the impression that the insurgent terrorists were freedom fighters, or they were heroes, or something like that. And with that kind of rhetoric, that does embolden terrorists. If you call them heroes, if you give the impression that the people support them, especially powerful states like the U.S., Britain, France, etc., that emboldens terrorism. That supports terrorism.
Ambassador Jaafari pointed to the role of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey in fueling the deadly violence in his country, adding that a recent UN report on human rights violations there failed to call on the three states to stop sponsoring the terrorist groups in Syria. More than 200,000 people have died so far in more than 3.5 years of fighting, according to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. Some 3.2 million Syrians have left the country altogether due to the fighting, while another 7.2 million have become internally displaced. As the world waits for the grand jury's report in Ferguson, Missouri, the state's governor, Jay Nixon, announced Monday that he had declared a state of emergency and was sending in the National Guard to maintain order. Shortly after the announcement, St. Louis Mayor Francis Slay told a press conference that the Guard would most likely not confront the protesters who have massed in the streets of Ferguson awaiting the grand jury's report. Laurel Krauss is a co-founder of the Kent State Truth Tribunal, organized to seek justice in the killings of four student protesters, including her sister Allison Krauss, at Kent State on May 4th, 1970. We spoke with her Tuesday. So, Laurel, we are first going to start with the mayor of St. Louis, Mayor Francis Slay, who gave a press conference late yesterday afternoon after Governor Jay Nixon, announced that he had signed an executive order, among other things, declaring a state of emergency and calling up the National Guard.
Well, I know the governor announced that he will be deploying the National Guard in the coming days in anticipation of a decision by the grand jury out in Clayton. And I wanted to make sure that you all had an idea of the way we viewed this was going to happen and what would happen with these guardsmen in the city of St. Louis. So how would we deploy them in the city of St. Louis? We don't know how many we're going to get yet, and we don't know exactly when they're going to be deployed, but we'll be finding that out very shortly. I wanted to make sure you knew what that would look like. This would be, from our standpoint, a secondary role. We would not have the Guard, on the front lines, interacting with, dealing with, confronting protesters. They would be used for three different approaches. One would be visibility, deterrence, and then the other, early warning. So they would be stationed at various locations within the city of St. Louis, shopping centers, strip centers where you have shopping, maybe some specific buildings like government buildings and those sort. They'd always be accompanied by a St. Louis police officer as well. So they would not be, as I said, they'd not be on the front lines dealing with protesters under any circumstance, except if it was some kind of a major issue came up where they were needed. But to keep in mind, they're going to be here just for kind of backup, backfill, and to protect various locations in the city of St. Louis. And the other thing is, we have our police officers are going to be deployed and have been deployed for quite some time over the past several weeks. They've been running 12-hour shifts for some time, so they are tired, and we'll be welcoming this backup support, by the way.
He makes it sound like the National Guard being called up isn't such a big deal. What are your thoughts on that?
It's always a big deal when there's a state of emergency, an executive order for that, and the National Guard are called. It reminds me when the National Guard were called related to Kent State, May 4th, 1970, and my sister Allison was one of four students, and she was a protester, actually, 343 feet from her shooters. She was shot dead by live ammunition from an Ohio National Guard acting as U.S. military on her campus. She was protesting the war. So here we have, you know, fast forward 44 years, and another governor in another state in the Midwest is calling in the National Guard in anticipation of protesters going to be creating mayhem, they think, in the town of Ferguson in response to the grand jury decision. And I wonder what good can become of this.
Yeah, he says the role is going to be visible, you know, in other words, not, that they're not going to be taking an active combat role, but what could they possibly be doing? And particularly with the police in Ferguson and in the surrounding area having been out in the streets now for a few months.
Yeah, he pointed to the police actually working 12-hour shifts and that they were weary and tired. And we wonder, I mean, they're orchestrating this grand jury announcement. For what purpose? Why are they, you know, putting this situation in where the police are, the law enforcement in the surrounding environs is tired and they have to call in the National Guard to relieve them? Basically, he said that they were calling them in for visibility, deterrence, and early warning. And we wonder about what are they going to be deterring? Will they be deterring the right for American protest? I guess what it's really coming down to is, you know, what is that decision going to be?
Yeah. You said something. Let me interrupt you for a minute, because you said something that kind of echoes May 4th, 1970. As I recall, one of the exculpatory alleged facts that were presented for the guards shooting into the crowd of students and selecting a couple of targets, including your sister Allison, was that they were stressed and overworked, that they had been at another assignment and deployed immediately to this one and they hadn't had enough sleep, which sounds like the condition the St. Louis mayor laid out for the local police there. Doesn't that sound kind of like the situation now?
It mirrors it perfectly. You know, people assume that the government forces and law enforcement and those in authority, you know, working on these kind of things have learned something since 1970 and that the practices are different. But actually, nothing has changed. In fact, it may be more militarized now because there's so much military gear across America. I wonder about whether or not these Missouri
right.
National Guard are federalized, because that's how they marched into Kent, Ohio, May 4th. You know, actually, they were there days before. They were instigating. They were part of the presence, the military presence. The military presence is not calming.
Yeah.
It only adds. And will they be carrying live ammunition? I think that's an important question.
Yeah,
in Missouri.
For sure.
And who? What are they deterring? Are they going to be deterring our right to protest when we don't agree with these decisions where law enforcement always gets away with murdering civilians? And when the military can kill protesters and civilians and also no accountability? That's the crux of what we're our interest in this. And we hope and pray that there will be not one protester killed in Ferguson. The truth from 1970 is calling for us to act as much as Michael Brown's fresh killing. It's very important for us to take a look at this, not from a civil rights position, but from murder. He was killed. He was executed, actually.
Yep.
And we have to look at it from that perspective, not civil rights, yes, there's race involved, and there's race involved in so many of these governments and killings by law enforcement, but there's also the overlying, overarching area, you know, concept, which is the government and law enforcement has the right to kill us, and there's no redress, there's no accountability, there's no justice. And the race car is involved in it, but there's also, this can happen to anyone of any race in America.
You know, I remember back in 1970, one of the cries that we were making in the streets back then was to bring the war home. And it appears, though, unfortunately, in a way, that we got a distorted version of that, because what happened is that people from Vietnam all the way through Iraq and Afghanistan that were sent over were trained in counterinsurgency techniques, essentially these kinds of killings of people to suppress the population that were brought here along with the equipment.
Yes.
What do you think about that on the streets of Ferguson now?
The cake is almost baked.
Yeah.
What can I say? I mean, I can stay here. I can raise the points. I can rally against. I can wail against. But it's going to take all of us. And here's the deal, you know, Kent State really happened to all of us. It wasn't just my family or those that got harmed directly. It was all of us. And the target for that wound, the Kent State wound and Jackson State wound, was meant for all of us. And it has worked very well. It stopped all efforts for us to really, you know, get traction, because people have a lot of pain around it, and they also call that post-traumatic stress disorder. It's varying degrees, but you know, and now they're at it again, and it's a slightly different recipe, but it's the same characters and the same force and power, and now they have this military might spread across America, and a lot of hate between the law enforcement and the military and average citizens. We're just troublemakers in there, and we have to be contained, and we have to be managed, and we have to be taxed, and we have to be, you know, we don't have a life, and we don't have a right to any peace. And they're going to take it away from us at every turn. And that's where we're at now. And I didn't create it. I'm just pointing it out, man.
Mm. You know, under the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment or Punishment, or the people call it the UN Convention Against Torture, but it covers all of that, there's a reporting requirement, which the United States has failed to comply with, that they got called on again last week regarding these kinds of killings, that they're supposed to report each and every killing of civilians, of people by the police. The Malcolm X grassroots movement issued a report, I guess it was last year, that every 28 hours a young black man is killed by police in the United States. That's a remarkable figure. What do you see going forward in terms of the UN standing up, you know, or the Committee Against Torture enforcing this and making the United States actually publish how many people get killed every year by police?
Yes, in 1994, it became a mandate that the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, document civilian deaths by law enforcement. And nothing has been done. Nothing. Not one little number has been. But do they keep track of the police being killed?
It's on the front page every time.
We have these grand, you know, funerals and the mourning and all that. But, you know, American dies, a civilian, and a protester, even worse. Until the Department of Justice and the U.S. government and states actually begin to, you know, honor civilian deaths, protester deaths, Americans being killed by law enforcement, by the military, by those in authority, and there actually gets some investigation related to that, It's not about civil rights, as that's how the United States pursues these elements. When Michael Brown was murdered, executed, the Department of Justice came in and said that we're going to start a civil rights investigation. And that's the process that they go about, because there's no mechanism within the United States government for there to be murder. You know, there's no mechanism. There's no way for justice to be claimed by an American civilian or a family of you know, a protester or whatever when they're killed. They go to civil rights, and it never is about the murder. And that happens all the time with law enforcement. There's just no way to charge. And that's one of the reasons why this grand jury is going to be coming back with the 9 indictments, because they don't have anything that they can indict with. They cannot charge because our system is broken. Mm. And I think that this actually, you know, my dream is to have a department of the federal government for, you know, the protection of citizens. Mm. Where we actually, you know, that's our job to, you know, to account, to take on cases where, you know, wrong has been done by law enforcement, where law enforcement has to start becoming accountable. And this could include the FBI, you know, as well as, you know, Department of Homeland Security. Right now, there's no recourse. If we've been wronged by any of those groups in America, you know, there's nothing you can do. That's it. Just like they did with my sister. You know, there was nothing. We fought it for 8.5 years in the courts. We got a statement of regret, $15,000, and not one law changed. No one learned a darn thing, and basically that's that. But what happened also was there was a civil statement that was published by my father and all the other people that were harmed by Kent State, and it was directions on how to change things. And suggestions on how things could be made better. And very specifically, in the 1979 civil settlement statement that was published by, you know, all those harmed at Kent State on May 4th at the Kent State Massacre, they called for ways for the justice system to have accountability when law enforcement and those in authority kill and use deadly force. And the UN is very concerned about this deadly force and excessive use of force. And the excessive use of force also fits into the torture element. It's not appropriate for law enforcement to go so unaccounted for. And that's the big emphasis of what the UN is, Human Rights Committee and the Conference Against Torture and the High Commissioner of the UN, you know, I can't speak for her, but I know the greatest demand is accountability when excessive use of force and deadly use of force is used by those in authority in America. It's a black hole. And Michael Brown's killing is pointing us to it, and Kent State, the massacre there that happened on May 4th, 1970, when 4 students were killed and 9 were injured by the U.S. military, that calls for that now. That calls for accountability, oversight. It must happen. Or we'll only have, this will become a daily thing.
Yeah. Okay, Laurel Krauss, tell us your website where people can follow the work you're doing.
Oh, yes, you can. Actually, I'm co-founder of the Kent State Truth Tribunal. Our website is www.truthtribunal.org. We're working for truth and justice related to the Kent State Massacre of 1970.
Okay, thank you very much. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.